You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. So welcome to episode 271. And in this episode, I interview Dr. Ben Sedley. Ben is a clinical psychologist from New Zealand. He has authored two books and runs a private practice called ACT Wellington. And in our conversation, we talk about Ben's therapy journey, what is acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT for short, how relational frame theory underpins ACT, how ACT can be useful for OCD. Ben gives examples of how ACT enhances ERP. He shares ACT's view of suffering. We talk about grief and OCD, his and Lisa Coyne's book, Stuff That's Loud, an ACT book for teens with OCD. Ben also talks about his book, Stuff That Sucks, the importance of listening to teens, the ACT metaphors that Ben likes, specifically for OCD, and much, much more. Wide-ranging conversation, lots of stories and examples in this one. So I think you'll like it. And thanks as always to NoCD for supporting the show and the work that we do. They are now in Australia. So if you're in Australia, firstly, thank you for listening to this show. But also, NoCD are now operating in Australia as well as UK and USA. So good work to NoCD for continuing their expansion. And thank you to them for sponsoring the show. And thank you to you guys, as always, for listening. I deeply appreciate it. And a special thanks to anyone from New Zealand who listen. And without further ado, here is Ben. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Hi, kia ora.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. And whenever I get a sort of clinician on, I like to ask them what made them get into their type of therapy.
That's always a strange, interesting question for me. I did psychology at university because I was an Alice Cooper fan and wanted to write music about struggles and suffering, not just Alice Cooper, incorporating the music and things. But then found I was just really enjoying psychology and it was really becoming meaningful. Years later, once I graduated, I was working as a clinician, I kind of got excited by things like Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning and discovering that when I was working with teenagers, which was my first job at a child and adolescent mental health service, the excitement I was getting from those sessions when I was sitting with a teenager and talking about what's the point of all this? What's the meaning of life? Why are we here? Rather than talking about, you know, what can we do to get you walking around the block or to be slightly less depressed or slightly less anxious. And it was around that time, over the next couple of years, I started reading about acceptance and commitment therapy and going, hey, wow, there's a therapy that lets me do this for a living. I can sit and talk with people about what they care about rather than trying to get people from the negatives back to zero. How can I help them get into the positives, work towards the life they genuinely value, give a crap about? So that's how I ended up in doing acceptance and commitment therapy, and that would have been 15 to 20 years ago now, and it's been a game changer for me. It's been really exciting process of learning about it and then learning how to do it with more precision and with incorporating more compassion work more overtly and incorporating more of the science, the relational frame theory that comes by, that's behind the ACT model. And as I use all these things, I feel like my work and there's both more precision and more flexibility. And that's been a really fun process for me.
Yeah, thank you for explaining. And you mentioned relational frame theory there. My next question was actually going to be, could you, in your own words, kind of explain what ACT is or how you perceive ACT to be? But also, if you could then talk about relational frame theory, because I don't think we've discussed that except for maybe when I interviewed Stephen Hayes back like 5 years ago, he may have mentioned it. I think he did actually. Yeah, so I get, and I don't know which order is best for you to answer that, so I'll throw both at you at once.
All right, well, we'll start with ACT. ACT is how can I take steps towards a life that matters to me, that's in line with my values, even when I've got thoughts or feelings or urges or sensations or memories that are uncomfortable, that want me to, that my instinct says, how do I get rid of these first so I can get on with my life? And what we know is the more you try and get rid of something, the more you've got it. Whereas if you say, actually, this pain, these uncomfortable thoughts, these mean thoughts, they might have to come along for the ride because life is short and this is where I want to, this is the direction I want to move in. Then ACT has ideas on how you can do that. Yeah, how do I move forward? And the discomfort can come along for the ride. So that's the ACT model. Relational frame theory gets a reputation for being very jargon heavy and complicated. And like all good science, you can dig deep and find the complicated parts. It is the science of the behaviorism, the science of language, that as children, we don't learn every single word. We learn how to form connections between words, and we learn how to derive relationships between objects, and we learn how to think abstractly and then draw connections between things. And without those connections, the words don't have much meaning. This is getting quite abstract already, so I'll give you an example. If, and I got this example from Louise Hayes, from a workshop I went to. Louise Hayes is a clinician just outside Melbourne who wrote the DNAV model. And if I picked up a big glass and a small glass and filled them both with water and asked you which one you want, you'd probably say, you'd say the big glass maybe. And if I told you that the big glass was filled with, that these glasses were filled with gold rather than water, then straight away you'd decide that the big glass was great and you'd want that and you'd feel really happy, right? And I'd give it to you and you're feeling great. And then you watch me pull out a even bigger glass of gold and hand it to the person sitting next to you. What's happened for you inside right now, Stuart, as I described that?
I feel a bit let down or inferior.
How are you feeling about that glass you're holding?
It's not that good.
Nothing's changed about the glass you're holding, right?
No.
But all these connections you're putting on it have changed really that quickly, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you've derived all these relationships between your glass and your emotions and what you want and how much you should be getting. And we build these relationships really, really quickly. And this obviously, you know, connects them with OCD really quickly, where I don't like bad things happening. And I also am, let's give a really more stereotypical example. Germs can kill people. And there are germs on my hands. If I think germs can kill people, then I have to get rid of the germs on my hand because I've associated all germs with killing people. And that isn't the case of the germs on my hand. But the concept of word germs has been fused in my mind, has been in a relational frame, as we say in the RFT, with killing people. And so straight away, I have to respond to the germs on my hand or the germs that my brain has told me might be on my hand in the same way as if I'm actually killing people. And nothing's changed about my hands except for the language I'm using in my mind.
So Yeah, that's really useful. It's a good illustration because RFT has baffled me for many, many years. And I haven't done the reading. I've always put it off because I think I'm afraid of trying to understand it. But in terms of inhibitory learning, then what comes to mind is inhibitory learning is obviously about creating a new learning. Because does that link into RFT if you're creating new learnings, which is new relational frames and connections, so that germs are no longer completely deadly? And there's actually these other relational frames that link in that are less black and white.
Well, I think with the inhibitory learning model is we're creating a new relationship with the word anxiety. Hmm. OCD is telling us that anxiety is something that can't be tolerated, must be got rid of. Certainty, we must have certainty. Uncertainty isn't a safe thing. And what we're doing with the inhibitory learning is we're creating a new relationships with those words, uncertainty and anxiety. Mm. And my experience is going, oh, anxiety, uncertainty, these are things I can tolerate. In fact, not just tolerate, these are things I love sometimes. I love going traveling to new places and not quite knowing how things work, or I personally don't, but there's lots of people who love skiing really fast down hills or jumping out of planes. And some of those people have anxiety or OCD as well. Mm. They just haven't formed that connection and going, oh, this. So what we're doing is we're changing the relationship with the concept of anxiety and uncertainty from something that's intolerable, will ruin my life. And we're developing a new relationship of, this is something that's going to take me new places or let me do new exciting things. And so so in terms of RFT, we've created a new relational frame. Trying to explain this without the jargon, that all the meaning that comes with my life is over was put onto anxiety. And now with the inhibitory learning, all the meaning that comes with trying new things, developing, having adventures is mapped onto the anxiety or onto those same feelings. So, yeah, the RFT fits in really nicely with the inhibitory learning model.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Thank you. My first question was really, really broad. How might ACT be useful for OCD, or how is it useful for OCD?
So I think ACT enhances ERP. Hmm. I say that when I was early in my getting excited by ACT, I thought ACT by itself could do everything, but I've realized that nope, the ERP is still the crucial factor for OCD therapy. However, ACT can enhance your ERP in many ways. It can, I'm going to start listing it and then realize I've missed something crucial. I think the focus on values is really useful when you're doing something really hard. If I'm asking you to do something that your OCD is telling you will put people's lives at risk, you have to have a why for doing this. So adding in the values component to the ERP and ACT and invent the concept of values. As talked about, Viktor Frankl was using in therapy decades before ACT, but I think the ACT approach is really useful for this. So having your why am I doing these scary things, not just to get rid of the OCD, but to have a life full of wonder and meaning and excitement, love. So I think ACT brings that. I think the ACT enhances the precision in terms of understanding the function, what is going on right now. If we understand thoughts and language as behaviors that are only observable by one person, which is how ACT approaches language, then we can say, hey, these are behaviors. I do this behavior, I get this response. What do I want to do next? I can observe this behavior occurring, and I can choose to try and get away from this behavior. Doing the compulsion will get me away from this thought, or I can choose to respond to this thought differently. So I think the ACT does that really well. And I think the therapeutic stance that comes with ACT of suffering isn't pathological. Pain isn't pathological. It's not something clients have. It's something that human beings have. And the clinician sitting in the room with you, that we all have thoughts and feelings that we don't want, that we're trying to get away from. And maybe your clinician doesn't have OCD, but your clinician has internal experiences that they don't want to have, that they want to get away from. They're not claiming to be sitting on the top of the mountain with all the answers. To be an NAC clinician, you're openly acknowledging that I'm climbing my own mountain. I've got my own struggles. I'm trying to figure out how to do it. But because I'm on a different mountain, when I look over at you and your mountain, maybe I can see some footholds that you haven't seen or some ways to climb up. And so I can bring my own experience and my own empathy and my own humanity to the therapy in a way that's not exclusive to ACT, but I think ACT brings really nicely into the therapy.
Yeah.
That's a few. I'm sure there's some others. I'm sure there's some ACT listeners right now going, wait a minute, you forgot this important bit. So we'll just stop there.
Really good. Thank you. Something that came to me, you actually mentioned it maybe, I'm not sure how long we've recorded right now, but say 10 minutes ago. And then you kind of talked to it just then about being an ACT practitioner is actually owning your own journey. And it's kind of like ACT, if, correct me if I'm wrong in this, ACT is about, I have to add this bit because I'm blanking. Well, that was it. It was seeing kind of human suffering and these difficult emotions as part of being human. It's not something necessarily to be fixed or solved. They can be along for the ride. That you never, it's humanity, it's human to have these emotions. And ACT kind of acknowledges that as opposed to trying to rid them.
I think that's a good summary of what's going on with ACT. I've been doing ACT for 20 years, and thankfully large parts of my life has gone really well. And so I haven't really had to test out lots of the ideas that I'm working with other people, and I can understand the principles. And 1 month ago, my mum died. And it's been, obviously it's awful, and I miss my mum every day. And it's been a real test for me of going, hang on, are the ideas that I'm talking about with other people, are these the ideas that I use for myself? Is an ACT stance, an ACT approach, what I do when I'm trying to make space for my own suffering right now? And it really is. There's times when, just really small examples of, it's only been a month, and right now, anytime anyone mentions a hospital, I drive past a hospital, I can just feel my insides kind of contract for a bit. And it's like, nope, we don't want to think about hospitals yet. We know they're there. We know that at some point we have to go back to them. But right now, I'm not ready for that. Let's keep away from that thought and that feeling. And that's a level of avoidance that feels okay normally. But then 2 weeks ago, I'd take my dad into a hospital for an appointment, and I think neither of us wanted to be in there, but we both understood this is our values, this is what matters to us. And then the next day, my daughter asked me to read her a book, and suddenly the characters are in hospital having this emergency procedure, and I could feel all these parts of me going, no, I don't want to have these feelings right now. And I could see my values of, no, this is my time with my daughter, this is the book she's brought to me, I can read this book to her. And not only that, it's okay if she sees me get a bit tearful about it during, which I did. And I was able to talk with her and just say, oh no, I'm just missing grandma right now. And one of the weirdest things about losing your parent is everyone just says, how are you doing, all the time. And I still haven't figured out a good answer, because the answer is I'm okay, and I'm sad a lot, and that's okay too. So that obviously it's not the same as OCD, which I've been dealing with. You know, I haven't been dealing with OCD this month. I've been dealing with grief this month, but the same principles of what are the thoughts and feelings that come up for me? And my instinct is, I don't want this. How can I get away from it? And sometimes that's appropriate. And sometimes it's like, no, actually, this thought or feeling's got to come along for the ride because something I value needs to be done right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. And I did actually have someone contact me a while back about doing an episode on OCD and grief. So as in, you know, I have OCD and they lost one of their parents and they were really struggling kind of grieving while having OCD. And it's a topic that I really wanted to cover, but I was also conflicted because for me, grief stands in and of itself. You know, you work with it. It doesn't, you know, but obviously it's going to complicate OCD as well. And it's going to maybe spur OCD on as well. But I don't know, I guess, is there anything else you wanted to say about dealing with grief separately or dealing with grief alongside OCD or just anything on grief? Because it's not something we've really discussed on this podcast. And yet it is a thing that will touch us all at some point.
Yeah. And it's not something I've had a chance to look up literature on about what dealing with OCD and grief. I will say the thing that I've learned is that for me, grief is about grieving is active process, doing things, doing rituals has been really important, but it's not. So being able to notice, hang on, I'm doing this active ritual towards grieving, lighting a candle, you know, some people have set cultures that tell them how to do the grieving. Some people need to come up with their own rituals and figure out what do I want to do. I want to go sit somewhere that was important to that person or throw stones into the sea or something. But for me, discovering the importance of rituals rather than just sitting around waiting for your heart to figure out what it needs to do.
Yeah.
And so as I'm talking out loud, I can hear how easy the OCD could jump in and try and play with that. But also how easy the OCD treatment, you might say, well, I'm not allowed to do rituals because I'm busy doing ERP. I'm trying to get away from rituals. Mm. And so again, using that, the question that we always ask as a clinician, particularly certainly as an ACT clinician of WTF, what's the function of this thought? What's the function of this behavior? And if I'm doing it to get away from a thought, then it's problematic. It's not going to help. Unless it is. If it's not helping, notice it's not working for you. Whereas the same thing, I might be doing a ritual that's actually helping me with the process. It's bringing me towards things that I want. And if we can't stop and say, what's the function of this behavior? Why am I doing it? Then it's going to be hard to tease out what is an OCD behavior versus something that might be really helpful for your grieving. Yeah, had some initial thoughts that I haven't really thought through yet.
I threw that on you, but no, thank you. That's useful. Yeah, I like the active process bit. It makes a lot of sense. Yeah, because it also gives you a semblance of control as well in a time that you probably feel deeply out of control or unsettled. Okay, so yeah, thank you for sharing. So we're going to go on to Stuff That's Loud, A Teen's Guide to Unspiring from OCD. I'm holding it up, but of course only you can see. But definitely check it out on Amazon or wherever it's sold. Obviously, you wrote it and you co-wrote it with Lisa Coyne, who's been on the show before. So shout out to her. So I guess, you know, what inspired you and Lisa to write this book for teens?
So I wrote Stuff That Sucks, which we might talk about later on, in my earlier book for ACT for Teenagers back in 2015, I think. And in 2017, I got to go to the World ACT Conference in Seville. And I went to Lisa's workshop And for anyone who's listening, who's had a chance to listen to Lisa talk, you probably had similar experiences to me of, oh my God, what am I watching right now? This woman is so connected to the people she works, and her heart is so there, and her brain is so there, and she's a tiny person. How she has such a huge brain and a huge heart, I don't know. And so that evening at the conference drinks, I got brave enough to go up and just introduce myself and tell you how amazing her workshop was, and asked if she'd seen my book. And and someone else joined our conversation, and we, as we're talking about OCD, this person started talking, and I could tell they were talking about their own. They didn't say it, but their question about, have you ever seen this subtype of OCD? It was pretty clear they were talking about their own experiences of OCD. And I was watching Lisa in a drink setting, not in a clinical setting, after she'd spent all day giving a workshop, being more open and present and connected and caring in her answer to this person she's talking to. You know, just, I can say that I've ever been in my life, and I hope that's not the case, but just like, wow, I'm getting a master class and just being completely connected and present right now. So I'm just fanboying a bit about, and so then I'm in this kind of fanboy position and just saying, by the way, have you seen my book Stuff That Sucks? And she's like, oh, wow, we use it in our McLean OCD clinic. And all the kids that come into the adolescent OCD inpatient clinic they've got over in Massachusetts, they get given a copy of Stuff That Sucks, and which just blew my mind and moved me. And a couple of weeks after the conference, she messaged me saying, the kids at in McLean said, why can't we have, can we have an OCD specific book? And she said, will you write? And I said, I will co-write it with you. At the time, I didn't know that Lisa was incapable of saying no. So I thought, I'm so lucky that she said yes. And Lisa and I, based on after one conversation in a pub in Spain, we agreed to write a book together. And it's just been a really special process of me bringing, you know, my experience working with teens and translating ACT ideas into teen-friendly language. And Lisa, who's also really good at those things, but also bringing all the specialty knowledge that she's had from all her years of being an OCD specialist. And we had in mind specifically thinking about those kids in McLean going, let's write the book that they've asked for. And then from there, if we write for them, hopefully it'll be helpful for all sorts of other people, particularly those people who aren't able to access therapy immediately. I'm talking about Lisa being a specialist because I'm in New Zealand and we don't have specialist anything. So we all did our generic psychology training and we all see everybody. And there's definitely no specialist OCD clinics or definitely no OCD inpatient services. But even for generic therapists, just to find any psychologist, you can't do that in Wellington. We're all at capacity. The private clinicians, the public can't even find psychologists to employ. And so realizing the importance of individual therapy is still incredibly useful, but not everyone's going to be able to access it for financial reasons, your geographical reasons, or just there aren't enough clinicians out there. And so the value of books and groups and websites and YouTube clips and podcasts like yours is just getting more and more important every day. And so Stuff That's Loud is my contribution. If you could find the perfect clinician, then you might not need Stuff That's Loud, or you might use it as a complement in conjunction with the therapy you're doing. But the reality is, there's lots of people in the world who aren't going to be able to access therapy, and they're going to be figuring out how to do it via books or websites or wherever else. And so it's been great to be able to work with Lisa and put together a jargon-free, compassionate, teen-friendly, illustrated short book that explains what helps people feel validated, feel understood, and feel ready to take some steps towards working on their OCD.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that story. We like stories on this podcast, so hence the name. I mean, the book is beautifully illustrated as well, I think, which is...
Huge shout out to Carlos Chan in Wellington for her illustrations and for Catherine Adam for all her design work. It was amazing. A dream team to work with.
Nice. So what would teens find in this book?
So firstly, hopefully they'll find that they're not alone. What we've done... So many, not just OCD books, but certainly OCD books, but I'd say most mental health books, most self-help books jump into, right, let me tell you how to fix your problems. And if I was picking up a book going, who the hell are you? Why should I listen to what you say?
Yeah.
And so in both the books I've written, there's a real emphasis on, let me do my best to show that I get where you're sitting, even though I haven't been able a chance to actually sit with you or meet you. Before I throw any suggestions at you. And so stuff that's loud begins with our explanation of what's happening when you've got OCD and how the way OCD keeps tricking you and pulling you into its games. We also include lots of stories, which are... They're real people's stories with enough details changed that they're not recognizable. And we're incredibly lucky to have a couple of teens actually use their names and use their real stories in there as well. So before you get to any, what should we do about it? You've got the first section of the book. You're going, hey, that's my story. This person's talking. Or that's not my story, but wow, if that person can deal with that, then maybe this is, I can deal with what I'm experiencing as well. So we have the big emphasis on helping you feel understood, which is always hard in the book when I'm not actually hearing your story. But we've done, that's our goal for the first half of the book. And then we break down the ACT-informed ERP process into four ideas, into... let's see if I can get the order right now. I'm opening up my copy. Into curiosity, willingness, giving a crap, and flexibility. And so that's the middle chunk of the book. And the final section of the book is how to work, be in your family, how to talk to your parents about what you need from them. Excuse me, how to build up other connections, other supports, troubleshoot some of the other things. And looking at some other things that help as well, the role of self-care, of sleep, eating, being thoughtful about the drugs you use, and a little section on medication and how to learn to listen to yourself on the medication as well. And we managed to do all that in... I was going to say less than 100 pages, slightly over 100 pages because we've got acknowledgements in there. Yeah. I'm a big believer in self-help books need to be short or no one's going to read them. I've got many on my shelf with great chapter ones and I couldn't tell you what happens beyond that.
Yeah, I agree. And as me, when I was a teen, I was prescribed, dare we say, by a psychologist, a couple of OCD books that were fairly chunky and I didn't read them. I bought them, didn't read them. They just sat on my shelf collecting dust because, and even to this day, if a book's too big, I feel defeated by it before I've even opened it. I need short books. And some teens obviously would love reading and they'll read long, long books. but many don't. So we need to kind of factor that in, because if we can't get them to read it, then what's the point?
They'll ask me what the secret is to writing a book, and I say, write a short book and use lots of pictures.
Yeah.
That's all you're going to get from me, I think.
Yeah, no, it's a good book. No, thank you for that as well, for breaking it down. Yeah, and how's it been received by young people, families, etc.?
I can't begin to say how special it is, heartwarming it is when I get a message that your book hit the spot for me, or your book hit the spot for my teen. You know, we don't often get much feedback in our job. Often we only see the people who keep doing badly, and the ones doing well go off and live their lives, and we never get to hear it. That's the nature of our job as therapists. But when I get a message that someone on the other side of the world, or in New Zealand too, that something I've written has helped them take the next step they need to do, that's just so special. I had early on, I had some clients just look at early drafts and come back the next week going, I tried this because of what you wrote. And that was just like, wow. You know, this is, we need lots and lots of books out there, just like we need lots and lots of different therapists out there, because there's nothing that's going to hit the mark for everyone. But when you actually hear that something, when I hear that something I've written has helped someone's life, that's just so cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so next question is, where's my question gone? Yeah, I would say there's lots of exercises in the book as well, which are quite cool. One of the pages I was flipping through earlier had very short exercises you could try quite quickly, like the ice cube one and
the curiosity workout.
That's it. There you go. I thought that was a really cool idea. Not the ice cube one, but all of them. So the next one is more for like parents. So I think you published republished a written interview on your personal website. And one of the questions was around, I've written it here, what are your top tips for parents who have teenagers struggling with their emotions? And you wrote, listen some more. Create opportunities where your teen might talk. If they start talking, be ready to listen. I really like this, and I just wanted to see if you could expand on it.
Yeah, it is. I've got three kids. It's advice that sounds really easy, and it's actually really hard, because often kids want to come and talk to you at times that you're just trying to get them to sleep or about to walk out the door, or there's some stuff that needs to be done. But it turns out there's always stuff that needs to be done. And the idea that if you aren't able to listen, or small kids, if you can't listen to what they think's important, then they're less likely to tell you what you think's important as well. My kids aren't teenagers yet, and I always worry that karma's going to come and mess with me for giving advice to parents with teenagers. But there's my magical thinking for you. But one thing I hear time and time again from the families I work with is I ask them when they have the best conversations, and they say, in the car. I'm driving my teen somewhere, and we just talk about whatever, and we talk about big stuff, and we talk about politics, and we talk about the music on the radio, and we talk about where they're at, and it's great. And then often the same parent or other parents, they're always talking about they want their kids to be more independent, and they needed me to drive them places where they should be able to take a bus, or they should be driving themselves by now. And yeah, teenagers need to be independent. But also, if that's the place where you're having your best discussions, then make sure that happens sometimes. Even if they could get home from whatever by themselves, maybe you go pick them up, because that could be where you have your best discussions. It's really hard when you're a parent and you love your kid to bits and they're talking about something, it's really hard to not give them the answers, because I can see the mistake you're making. I made the same mistake, and I want to give you all my ideas about what helped me or what I wish I'd done or whatever. And teens don't need that. Sometimes they do. Sometimes I might specifically say, what do you think? But more likely they want to have a space where they can kind of figure it out, create their own, take their own safe risks and maybe make their own safe mistakes and feel cared for and loved and valued. Even so, even with that happening, I think one of the ways that ACT has often been rolled out with teens is grown-ups telling teens what they should be doing. And I don't think that works either. I think, and the evidence for ACT for teens isn't as strong as you want, because teens don't need to be told the answer. They need a space where they can figure it out for themselves. And so parents need to listen and notice that they've got their own desire to charge in and fix or give a solution, and actually just listen. As I say, how can I be interested in what you're thinking and what you're feeling and really care about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's reason it resonates for me is I just think it's such an important lesson for anyone in life, but like for parents as well. Just, yeah, we all need to be heard sometimes and be seen. Okay, so we've done that one. Yeah, okay. So obviously metaphors are a big part of ACT. What are some of your favorite metaphors?
Metaphors are a huge part of ACT. One of my favorite metaphors, they keep changing a lot. My favorite thing is how working with someone and making up a metaphor that makes sense to them. So if someone's talking about they feel like, great, mind freeze right now. There's a metaphor for you. Let's say they were talking about like they're drowning. And so to be able to sit with that and say, okay, what's needed right now then? What do you need to do if you're drowning? Because right now you're using strategies that might work really well when you're safe on land, but right now you feel like you're drowning, so none of these strategies are going to work for you, eh? How do we, when you're drowning, you need to signal for help. You need to, depends on the situation of the drowning, of course, and we're going to be able to expand it, but, you know, what do you need? How do you reduce the panic, get closer to shore, breathe, whatever? And we sit there and notice, okay, well, I'm the one who's used this metaphor. I've used this example. So I'm going to actually sit with it and go, well, if this was a situation, what would I need? And if once I've figured out what I need, we can then say, well, what's that going to look like? What does, there's a very famous ACT metaphor of Steve Hayes talks about being caught in quicksand, like in an old cowboy movie. No teenager I've worked with has ever watched an old cowboy movie. And it's a terrible metaphor for the young people. But we've adapted a lot to being caught in the rip. And if you grow up near the sea, as almost everyone does in New Zealand, or in most parts of Australia and lots of parts of other countries, you'll know that you might be swimming and get caught in the rip. And hopefully you've learned that when you're caught in the rip, your instinct is to panic and try and swim straight to shore, and that gets you pulled in faster. And actually what you need to do is swim along with the rip as you kind of come out as you move alongside it. And so using that as a metaphor for your instincts telling you one thing, I want to struggle, I want to get out of here, and that may not be really effective for you right now. What's going to be effective for you right now to help you in this situation? As I'm talking now, I thought about my favorite OCD metaphor. So I'm going to jump in with another one if that's cool.
Yeah.
Because we talk about And I'll do this early on as my way of explaining to the clients the kind of work that we're going to be doing. And it doesn't resonate with everyone, but it resonates with enough people for me to keep trying it. Let's say that there's a bank robbery and the alarm's going off and you are a detective, police officer, rushing to the scene. In my mind, I always kind of picture this, some really classic Miami Vice police officer, because I want to be in a really snazzy car. But either way, you get there and there's a witness going, "I just saw the bank robbers run that way." So you're like, brilliant. And you set off and you start chasing off down the street after that robber. But you can't find them. So you go back to the witness and go, "You said they went that way." And the witness is like, "Oh, my mistake. I think I meant that way. They went right." So you go rushing off down that way again, hoping to find them. And again, you can't find them. So you go back to the witness again and you're like, "Where's this robber gone?" But as you're asking the question, you notice that the robber is wearing a ski mask and holding a big bag that says, the eyewitness is wearing a ski mask and holding a big bag that says loot. And noticing that's what OCD is like. It's sending you off on these tangents. It's telling you the problem is harming someone or germs or something, you're being immoral or whatever it is. So you're rushing off after it. You're doing exactly what you should be doing based on the wrong information. You're doing the right thing at a really unhelpful time. And when you stop and go, "Wait a minute, the problem isn't the information I'm dealing with, it's the source of the information," and noticing that actually this witness is lying to me, it's telling me the problem is I'll be a bad person or I'll hurt someone or any of the million different things, the ways that OCD can lie to us. Actually, the problem is OCD is telling me you can't tolerate uncertainty. You can't handle this discomfort. Then I can look at it and I can see where the work's going to be. And that's where the work, and that's where I lead into the work of curiosity. I can hear what you're telling me, and I'm curious about what other information is out there. Starting with, I'm noticing the ski mask you're wearing and the big bag of loot you're holding. Not sure why my robbers look like the Beagle Boys from the Disney in this story. And so I'm bringing the curiosity. I can hear what you're telling me, and I'm also curious about what other information is out there. And then I'm taking those willing steps of, I can hear what you're telling me and I can choose how I want to respond. I can choose to go running off in the directions you send me, or I can choose to try something different, to not run off just because you tell me it's time to run off and go running off after those bank robbers you've made up. And then we add in the flexibility of, you know, how do I use this as situations change, as the bank robber tells me different things, tries to tell me different lies, and I can still use the same skills and the same curiosity and the same willingness any situation you're throwing me in. So that bank robber metaphor is one that I use a lot in an early on when I'm trying to explain the model of OCD that we're going to be working with.
Yeah, thank you. I like that. And I also like the personalizing them to the person, because I'm sure it lands better and sticks with them more. Okay. I sometimes like to ask therapists or clinicians when I get them on the show, how has their view of treating OCD changed in the last few years, if it has? Whether that's something you've learned or something you do differently or...
Huge. Everything. As I said, in New Zealand, we're all trained to be generalists, and I thought I was okay at OCD. And the last several years have just been this amazing opportunity of upskilling. The inhibitory learning model that, well, I don't know when it was. It certainly wasn't even published yet when I was a student, but it's it wasn't one that I'd known about 3 or 4 years ago, and just noticing how much has changed my therapy from switching from habituation model to the inhibitory model, and how much it sits better next to ACT and RFT than the habituation model does. Which I think is probably why I wasn't doing ERP well enough when I got first excited by ACT, because habituation is about reducing your anxiety and ACT is about living with your anxiety, making space for it. And then have inhibitory learning model was like, okay, this is when they all fit in together nicely again. I also, I think I look back on some of the early work I did and think, actually, either I missed OCD with that person, and unfortunately, so many people with OCD have stories about being missed, mostly because they didn't have the words for it, but also because clinicians have their own things that they're focused on. And sometimes I look in and go, hey, I missed it, or didn't miss it, but I was a bit slow to pick up that actually what they're describing as an OCD. And I hope that I'm faster at doing it now and more able to see more of the variation that comes with OCD than I was a few years ago. But I just do think it's partly me being a bit of a slow learner, and partly actually some of the innovations that are happening in ACT now and OCD therapy now, like incorporating ACT, and all Michelle Krask's work and the inhibitory learning is actually changing it. So it's things I'm learning. Some of that are slow to learn and some of it wasn't there yet a few years ago.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. Okay, and then so a couple more random questions now. So you pick up the phone and call 20-year-old Ben. What did you tell him?
Oh, that's a good question. 20-year-old Ben. Certainly had no idea he'd be a clinical psychologist. I like 20-year-old Ben, though, so I don't want him to do anything different. He was living with two of his best friends in a flat, and we were studying at university together. But it was all just a bit, obviously, unfinished. A whole lot of different things that I look back now and go, oh, those are some ideas I was trying to make sense of back then. Ideas about my own cultural connections. I was a bit vague about, you know, how I wanted to fit in within the Jewish community, how I wanted to fit in within the Wellington community. And oh, as I'm trying to think about anything I want to say to him, I get back to that same point I said earlier on about actually you've got to go make those mistakes. And I guess, yeah, I mean, when I think about the things I regret, it was the times I made judgments, made assumptions, I failed to listen to people. And so I'd like to look back and just say, just shut up and listen. But I also don't want to go back and say that, because the reason I know that now is because I made the mistakes. And so it's an interesting question, which I haven't got any great answer to, except I look back and I'm horrified by some of the stupid things I said and some of the stupid things I did. And obviously a big part of me wishes I didn't do them, but also you don't get to be a person if you don't do those things. So I wouldn't even want to go back and stop them.
Exactly. And you wouldn't have the learning if you didn't do it.
No. I'm guessing I can't go back in time and tell myself what to invest in or something like that.
Yeah. No, fortunately not. Although that would have been a good answer. No one's actually ever said that, I don't think.
Apple shares.
Okay, so you've got a billboard in Wellington. What do you want written on that billboard?
That's a good one. The first thought I had was, don't be a dick. But actually, I want something more positive. So it's going to be give a shit. Care.
Everything or?
No, not what you care about.
Yeah. Okay.
Figure out. So actually, I did do that in Stuff That Sucks. Yeah, I had a little picture and it's just one page of a billboard and I could stand by that. And it just says, figure out what you care about and care about it. So I think I'd happily see that on the billboard somewhere.
Yeah.
Figure out what you care about and care about it.
So I like it. And then lastly, is there anything that you wish you could have shared today?
I haven't had a chance in this podcast to really talk about how in awe I am of all the people I work with, the people with OCD, the people I hear tell their stories on this podcast or I read about in the books. I know that in the last week, I've got to say, I was terrified about doing this podcast. It's been on my mind a lot. But mostly it's been a lot of avoidance going, I'm not going to think about it too much because this is terrifying for me. You interview some of the brainiest, most specialist OCD clinicians in the world, and you interview people bringing their own stories and their own hearts, and me thinking, who am I? What do I have to bring to this conversation? Am I going to say something really dumb? It's been terrifying for me. And I was thinking, every day I ask people I work with to do scary things. So for that reason alone, I have to front up and do this interview when you invited me, because even though it's scary, it's okay to do scary. It's important to do scary things to get where you want to go to. But then the next thought I have was how lucky I am to have grown up in a family and a culture with a group of friends that taught me it's okay to take risks and it's okay. And if I screw up badly, I'll be able to bounce back. It's going to be okay. And just really highlighting my privilege, my personal privilege of who I am, in terms of the luck of the family I grew up in, but also being a white male, noticing that the work that we're doing with OCD is taking steps, taking huge risks, and noticing that everyone's not starting from the same starting point, both in terms of the OCD, but also in terms of, is it okay to take risks? And to be really compassionate and mindful of that, saying, yes, you're going to have to take risks, but I don't get to tell you how big the risks should be or what the risks should be. I just need to have my eyes open and my ears open and notice and listen and care and be supportive and say the risk that you're ready to take right now, that's the risk we can take, rather than the risk that your therapist tells you or the book tells you or anything else.
Yeah, very good point. Yeah, wow. Thank you. Thank you for ending on that note. And it's been a real pleasure to speak to you, talk about ACT and your books and, yeah, your work.
Thank you so much. This has been... It's been fun. Now I'm trying to say, am I still now I'm scared about what's going to happen when it drops, and I guess we'll find out. But I know that I'm not going to be the most controversial speaker you've ever had, so that's also good to know. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip / donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. Thanks also to NoCD for sponsoring the show. For more information, please click the link in the episode description. A quick disclaimer, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.